It's a village. Yeah.
this evening. We will go ahead and get started. It is 5:30. This is the meeting of the Community Services and Safety Committee. I am joined by council members Zachy Dunn and Deshaun Quinn, as well as our guest, David Kirschenbaum, members of the public, I think, and city staff.
And my partner, Timothy Goss.
Oh, Timothy. Okay. Hi, Timothy.
Hello.
I thought you were a community member. So tonight we have a special guest, David and Timothy, here to talk to us about the public defense work that they do for the city. I really appreciate you guys coming tonight and preparing a presentation for us. We will go ahead and start off the meeting with your presentation. I just want to give a heads up to others that I may be moving things around the agenda because we have such a big agenda and there are items that we need to vote on, as well as folks who got cut off in their presentation at our last meeting that I hope we could get in and out. Deshaun, do you have a question, something you want to say?
Not so much a question. I'm glad you touched on it. There's some real weighty stuff that I would love that we give the grace of the presenters to get through it because it's a lot of good stuff that we need to know about. And so you got my support to really let folks really go through in detail their presentations. Sorry, I didn't even mean to take up that much time.
So here are my thoughts. And you guys, like before we even get started, just so we can set expectations out at the beginning, I'll have David and Timothy go first. They're our guests. They could leave after the presentation so they don't have to stay for the rest. I would like to move, Chief Deputy Eric Lund after that. And because he started his presentation last week and didn't get to finish it, then I'll go to Deputy Chief Golden because that item is something that we need to vote on, which is currently the last item on our agenda. We'll go to that. And then I'll let Chief Drever decide which item he wants to address first. There's the legislative work as well as the department report, and at least in my opinion, I'll let you pick, Chief Drever, what you want to go first, but the legislative information might be more pressing, but I'll let you decide that. Does that sound good to everyone? Does anyone have, okay, council members are nodding. All right, we will go in that order then. All right, David,
I'll put up the presentation and
And it sounds like you guys are pretty busy. We'll try to move as quickly as possible.
No, take your time. We're glad you came tonight. Don't try and rush too much. Maybe I'll just put on the council members to ask quick, precise questions. And if we need you to come back, we'll ask you. So go ahead.
I'm Timothy Goss, and I've been a public defender in the city of Tukwila since 1994. My partner is David Kirschenbaum, and we are the partners in the firm that Tukwila hires to handle public defense. In 1963, the Supreme Court decided the Gideon versus Wainwright case. And what that decision decided was that anytime any government was going to prosecute somebody for a criminal offense, they had to provide them with an attorney if they couldn't afford one of their own. And that was back in 1963. Now, David's going to do a little more about the history of public defense in Tukwila, and then I'll start talking more about the nuts and bolts of what exactly we do. But he's been in public defense in Tukwila closer to that Gideon versus Wainwright decision than we are now. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Kirschenbaum without saying too much about how old he is. And if you
good
want
evening,
to
everybody. Sure. I started doing public defense for the city of Tukwila in 1984. At that point in time, the judge was a gentleman named Frank Payne, who was a public defender's dream because Frank Payne did not believe that anybody should go to jail for anything who was charged with a misdemeanor. And most of the cases at that time were all theft cases. The mall was there, and back then, a first time theft would most likely be a $350 bail forfeiture. They kept track of first offenses. That was the primary caseload. We had court half a day 1 week and a full day every other week. So it was a very small calendar. And we had a probation officer, Preston Case, who used to work at the Southeen County Recovery Centers, and he would evaluate people to see if they had chemical dependency problems, and that's basically the way the cases went. Over time, the caseload got larger when Allentown was annexed. That changed the types of cases and the quantity of cases. We started getting a lot of domestic violence cases. We started getting more DUI and traffic stuff. Thefts were still rampant, and heroin was becoming a real problem back in the late 80s and early 90s. And so we had a lot of repeat offenders. The judges switched out to judges who didn't have the same problem with jail time as Frank Payne did. Jurisdictions over time have changed from basically all misdemeanors to now you have domestic violence cases and DUI cases where the court can have jurisdiction up to 5 years. There's now mandatory jail time, mandatory minimum penalties for these types of offenses. And the whole mentality has changed dramatically. When I first started public defense, it was a per case basis. That was way before the ACLU got involved and the law changed in 2012, where you went from a per case basis to full-time legal equivalence. And because of the changes in 2012 with the court rules and the way public defenses are required to do their work, I used to support Tukwila's public defense calendars with my private practice. Nowadays, because of the ACLU and the way the Supreme Court's changed the rules, it's a full-time legal equivalent model. So now the city allows me to be a full-time public defender, pay all my bills, properly represent clients. We have investigators through the city. We have interpreters through the city. We have all kinds of things that are available to us now that has dramatically changed since I started in 1984.
All right. And I guess you want to move the next slide there, David?
Absolutely.
This basically is just we thought we'd start with just a brief description before we get into the answers to your questions with what happens when we get assigned a case. Now, when the court appoints a client to us, they send us a document electronically called a notice of appointment. And when we get that notice of appointment, we start our process. And we generate a couple of different documents. One is a notice of appearance, and we send that to the prosecutor's office and to the court, and it basically says, we're now the official attorney of this person. You no longer want to talk directly to them. You need to talk to us because we're representing them. Second document we generate is a request for discovery. That we send that to the prosecutor, and it tells the prosecutor, hey, we're representing this person. We need your police report and any other evidence you intend to use in prosecuting this person. And over time, that's really changed. The amount of video we now receive is incredible. Those files are big and they require a lot of time to process. Tukwila now has body cameras on officers almost all the time. So even a simple shoplifting case can have a couple of different officers with half hour videos in each particular case. So the discovery process has become more complex, but it's important for us to review whatever we get. The third thing we do is get in touch with the client. Under the contract we have with the city of Tukwila, we're required to reach out to our client within 2 business days of getting appointed. And that's important because we want the clients to understand that they do have an attorney now, and we want to try and get to them, answer their initial questions before too long. We also want to confirm contact information. Sometimes that information can change over time, and if you can't get a hold of your client, it makes things very difficult. We also like to set up an appointment. Sometimes a client will need an appointment with an interpreter, and as Mr. Kirschenbaum pointed out, Tukwila provides us with access to interpreters, so we can set up appointments with interpreters. And in the more complicated cases, you know, we want to talk to everybody before they go to court so that they have some idea of what to expect, some idea of what's happening, because we get a wide range of folks, from people who are facing their first criminal charge of any kind ever to crafty veterans who've been, you know, before many courts many times before. So it's important to make an appointment so we can try and get their side of the story and explain the process. Now, I guess the rest of what we do, we can explain through the responses we made to the questions. And I think we've prepared some slides along those lines. Is that right, David?
That's correct.
All right.
So advocating for the clients. I'm not very good with PowerPoint. I keep going to the wrong button.
All right. When we get appointed to a case, as I said, we're asked for the police report, and that's sort of the first glance we get at a case. We get a hold of that police report and then break it down. We look at the facts. We look at the legal issues that might be raised. Is there a constitutional search and seizure type of issue? Is there an issue with credibility regarding some of the witnesses? Is there an obvious bias by one of the witnesses? Is one of the witnesses drunk? We have to try and analyze where are the weaknesses in the case. Next, we want to meet with our client and get their version of what happened. Sometimes it's identical to what's in the police report. Most often it's not. That's where a private investigator can come in. That's where the reviewing of video comes in, whether it's body camera video generated by the police or surveillance video from a store or an apartment building. It's important to fully understand the case before you start negotiating with the prosecutor. And it's also important to understand the case so that you can educate your client. You know, let them know, is this case a strong case that they have, or is it not a very good case? Because it's important for them to understand, you know, what their likelihood of success is, and try and get them to be realistic about what the potential outcomes are. When we advocate with the prosecutor, we point out, you know, what we think are the strengths and weaknesses of the prosecution's case. We try to mitigate the potential harm to our clients by pointing out the things that they are doing that are positive, their lack of criminal history, the fact that they have made progress in treatment or holding down a job, and reasons for them to try and work with us to try and reach a resolution that's favorable to our clients. We're not always going to reach an agreement, though. You know, there are certain cases where we'll read it and see a legal defense that's very strong and say, listen, we don't want anything in this case except for you to dismiss the case. That may be based on the facts. It may be based on our client's approach. Some clients aren't interested in a deal. And when that's not possible, that's when we set a case for trial. Dave, next one.
Yep. Lack of resources lead to uneven playing field. There we go. You know, the client's inability to post bail, unable to maintain a job, those types of things. When you're impoverished, eligible for a public defender, you don't have the same abilities you would have if you have a private lawyer, full-time job. For instance, treatment, sometimes getting somebody in treatment is as important as anything else in a case. And somebody who has resources can be in treatment the next day, where our clients sometimes wait in jail for 45 days to get into an inpatient program through a screener that comes to the jail. A lot of times people can afford to post bail, or our clients can't, or electronic monitoring while they're waiting, or work release while they're trying to do their job, and people who don't have resources can't do that. So there's a financial strain, there's homelessness, so getting a hold of clients and those types of things is a very difficult task, and mental health and chemical issues. While the Affordable Care Act has made a lot of things available to people, which didn't occur before, it doesn't make it immediately available. Those resources are in high demand, and there's a number of people trying to do those things, so there's availability scarce, and you have to go to walk-in clinics as opposed to having appointments through, you know, better insurance policies, those types of things. So it's really trying to keep those clients on an even keel with the clients who are well off or have, you know, good economic situations is really a challenge. We try to accomplish that as best we can.
And as Mr. Kirschbaum alluded to, you know, some of the challenges are simply staying in touch with our clients. You don't really think about it, but imagine trying to navigate this world with your phone turned off every 30 or 45 days because you can't pay a bill. And then when you get a new phone, it's through a different carrier, a cheaper carrier, and now you have a different number. You know, how hard would that make it to be to hold down a job, to communicate with everybody you know? And, you know, it's not always the first thought everyone has is, oh, I better let my lawyer know about the new phone number I have. Especially now where we're doing so much on video, maintaining contact with our clients is one of the most important and primary things we have to do. And it is difficult for folks who, you know, who don't have the kind of resources necessary to keep a stable address and keep a stable phone number. Another big challenge is facing the collateral consequences of cases. A lot of times folks think about jail time as the real problem with a criminal case. You don't want to go to jail. You don't want a big fine. But really, with misdemeanor cases in this day and age, it's the things that happen outside the courtroom that can be so devastating. If you get a theft conviction on your record, suddenly it makes it very hard to get a good job. You get an assault conviction, you may never be able to rent an apartment again, or you may lose your Section 8 housing. Tukwila is an incredibly diverse place. It's always been very welcoming to refugees from all different parts of the world. And so we have a lot of clients with immigration issues collateral to the criminal charge itself. Fortunately, Tukwila pays for us to be involved with a defender association in Washington, where we have basically immigration attorneys on call, where we can send them our clients' information and they can give us an immigration consultation so that we can keep those folks apprised of what risks they take and what potential things to look out for from an immigration perspective. So it's these collateral consequences a lot of times that are the most important things to a client, because frankly, Tukwila has evolved again and now is in a phase right now where jail time isn't the primary goal. Most of the time it's a rehabilitative model in Tukwila, and I really appreciate that. It's efforts made from Judge Walden and even from the prosecution to try and get somebody help rather than just put them in jail. Obviously, there are certain crimes that have mandatory jail time or certain folks that just pose the kind of risk that jail time requires. But in general, it's a rehabilitative model. But as Mr. Kirschenbaum said, that doesn't make it easy to get somebody into treatment. That's one of the things we have to work at a lot.
Just to add something, the clear proof that Tukwila Court runs that way is Tukwila doesn't have a probation department. They have court support services. And a lot of courts have probation departments where all they're doing is setting up their clients for failure. Mindy Briner, the court support service person, she's trying to actually help people follow through if they need food or that kind of stuff. She'll help them, tell them where to get all that kind of stuff. She's just the court's really good that way as far as being supportive in getting people services and the like.
Mm-hmm.
The balancing the caseload is a lot comes with experience. A lot of it has to do with the fact they changed the rules regarding public defenders. It's a lot easier to balance the caseload when the public defenders are properly paid and they have time to do this. They're not trying to balance private calendars or private practice versus public defense. They have all the resources they need. The funding is such that they have access to research facility, a good research library, good investigators, good interpreters, all those types of things where you can actually keep your stress levels down and be an effective advocate for your clients. And so that's the way the system's set up now, having dedicated public defenders really makes it a lot easier to balance your caseload, to keep your stress levels down, all those types of things. And that goes with what I was just saying about understanding the work, good expectations of outcomes, good communication, all those types of things that keep your stress levels down, keep your client's stress levels down, which is very important also, and allows you to be an effective advocate. I think I'm kind of still in the show here. I don't mean to be doing that. But the communicating with incarcerated clients, most of our clients are in SCORE, which is obviously the city of Tukwila knows they're a partner in that particular facility. Before the pandemic, we'd go meet with our clients in the visitation room. It was face-to-face, but there's a big glass wall, and we weren't allowed to take our communications or our computer or any communications devices. We couldn't really do research ahead of time, those types of things. With the pandemic, we're mainly visiting clients with Zoom, and the jail staff is very good about giving us privacy while we're on Zoom. They're good about getting our clients documentation they need as far as pleas or paperwork or discovery that we want to go over with them. And they're good about setting up appointments and those types of things. So the fact of the matter is, while I'd much rather see a client face-to-face, with the way the rules are set up at SCORE, it's a much more effective visitation when we can do it from our office on Zoom, because we can actually look up where their warrants are, those types of things. We communicate directly with them. We can set up appointments whenever we need to, and they're pretty good about setting up as long as they're not too busy. So that's one of the benefits of the pandemic, is a better system for visiting our clients in jail. Even though it's not in person, it's much more effective visitation. And I think I just went through most of that stuff right there. Feedback on prosecutors?
Yeah, I think that I touched on this earlier, that we have pretty strong disagreements in individual cases with the Walls firm. There's definitely cases where we don't see eye to eye and go back and forth quite a bit. But in general, I do think that their philosophy is appropriate for where the court's philosophy is in terms of understanding that a lot of the problems these folks face, come from addiction and mental health issues, and that if we can address those, it's a much more effective way to try and treat these cases than simply trying to lock somebody up. There are still courts around, not some of them even share a border with Tukwila, where jail time is still the primary response to these kinds of cases. And certainly there's room for jail time when somebody who's a domestic violence abuser or multiple DUI driver. But when we're talking about property crimes, trespass, the typical problems associated with homelessness, just doesn't seem like that's an effective way to spend money, and it's certainly not a humanitarian way to approach these cases. And I think in general, while I do disagree with Mr. Wallace a lot, I think his heart's in the right place in terms of adopting that philosophy.
And the pendulum's also starting to swing that way. There's a case called State versus Blazina, where for a long time these little municipal courts, and not Tukwila, Tukwila has always been an exception, but the municipal courts have been trying to support their courts based on misdemeanor defendants. And they still impose a large cost and that kind of stuff. Well, Blazina indicates it's created a situation where somebody can be statutorily indigent and the court doesn't impose costs and fines on those people so that they don't get deeper behind the ball in order to get better in their lives. They don't worry about legal financial obligations to move on, which is a real asset. It made a big difference in how the courts deal with the indigent defendants.
And I guess the last question on that list was what kind of things would we like to do if we had some additional power in terms of what we could do more with defense. And the one idea that I keep coming back to is that right now the collateral consequences, as I pointed out, are a lot of times the primary problem people face. And I wish there was a way that we could limit access to misdemeanor data, especially if it's data that isn't a conviction. There's a lot of cases that we get dismissed basically because of a problem with the legal or factual basis in the case, or sometimes it's because we entered into a diversion program. The city will let a first-time theft case, if they do a bunch of community service, they take an anti-shoplifting class, and they stay out of trouble for a year, they'll offer a diversion so it allows them to keep that from becoming a criminal conviction. And that's a good system for first offenders. A lot of the times our first offenders are young people who made one bad decision, and they shouldn't have to carry that around for the rest of their lives. But unfortunately, even in cases that are dismissed, with the information age we're in, you'll get employers or landlords getting a hold of this information and holding it against people who haven't even been convicted. And, I think that the use of that information should be limited in even in cases of conviction. I certainly don't think that this information should be used against people who weren't even ever found guilty. But increasingly, we see people losing jobs, people losing access to housing because of things that got worked out in court that didn't even result in conviction. And trying to minimize the damage of these collateral consequences is one thing we're always working on, and it would be a lot easier if that wasn't. That wasn't information that was readily available for anyone who asked for it. But there's only a couple states right now that have adopted anything like that. Massachusetts is one. I'm hoping that something like that will happen in Washington, because at the end of the day, these are misdemeanor offenses, and we really don't want them necessarily to be the kind of thing that makes it really hard for someone to get to a place of comfort in society where they can work and live and feel safe once they've put their past behind them. Anyhow, I think that's it for our slides. Is that right, Mr. Kirschenbaum?
I think so. The only thing I'd add to what Mr. Goss was saying, and I didn't write it up, but I've always felt this, if somebody's got a felony and they're in King County Jail and they've got all these little misdemeanor cases all over, like in Kirkland or Kent or Tukwila, the Superior Court has concurrent jurisdiction. And I always thought it'd be nice to, instead of somebody going to prison or that kind of stuff, they have to come back and deal with all these warrants on these municipal courts, that all the courts, all their cases got put into the same court at that point in time. So when the, if they went to prison or they dealt with their felonies, they wouldn't have to get out and still deal with the records of the past that's still out there and hasn't moved a minute while they've been in jail for 6 months or a year or more.
And if anybody has any questions, we're happy to answer them, but we really appreciate the opportunity to speak in front of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your presentation. We had talked about this as a council to have both our public defense group and our prosecutors present to us, because it's important to know all the pieces of the criminal justice system, all the players, as we try and figure out how to address some of the issues that exist with the criminal justice system. So I appreciate your perspective. I open it up for questions to my fellow council members, and we'll start with Council Member Quinn.
Thank you for your presentation. There's a huge opportunity to ask a bunch of questions, but I want to thank you for how well you put it together and obviously being proactive and answering questions. So I'll just ask you one question. There's something that you said that was very interesting to me around agreement, around resources needed. And I would just be curious, separate from data information that obviously can be challenging for people, I'm thinking more of data rolled up in the need for mental health services, the need for drug and alcohol treatment services. Is there a space where you actually collect that information? Because that's the kind of thing that I think would be valuable as an elected leader and to the public, like how many folks really need services versus the amount of services that are actually available out there.
I don't know the exact answer to that question. Most of our clients, and especially the repeat offenders, are either chemically dependent, mental health problems, or both. And while that's changed dramatically, I don't know if you're familiar with Saw Mental Health, for instance. That used to be a small organization. Now they're huge. In fact, from my perspective, they may have gotten too big to actually be effective dealing with the clients that we have. But there's waiting lists to get – even our clients, there's waiting lists to get into these services. And that's assuming our clients are citizens. The clients that we have that are immigrants or not necessarily lawfully here, they're not eligible for those services. So then you got to find different agencies who are endowed enough that they can willing to take those clients on or reduce the cost of those enough that those clients can take part in those services. So it's let me put it this way. When I have a client in jail who's chemically dependent and the deal is to get them into released inpatient treatment, it takes, generally speaking, 45 days from the date they get evaluated in jail to get out of jail into an inpatient program.
And I don't know if any of you saw an article in the Seattle Times over the weekend about just the gap between the amount of need and the number of inpatient bed space available. And that's a lot of times what people need who are coming off the streets. An outpatient program may be helpful, may give them some good ideas, but it doesn't give them the structure of an inpatient treatment program. And that article was a little bit depressing because it indicated that since COVID, we've actually lost some of those bed spaces. So we're further behind than we were before. And well, as Mr. Kirschenbaum points out, the folks who are in jail, it is a long wait, but at least they're stable and we can get a hold of them 45 days later. Whereas somebody, you know, who's homeless, if they got to wait 60 days for a bed date, the chances of us being able to track them down, them still being willing to accept the bed date, you know, those numbers go down. But this long gap between the need and when it's available is a real problem.
And the other side of that 45-day, I don't mean to interrupt, but I just want to make sure that you're aware that once they get through the 45-day order, get an inpatient, get done inpatient, if they're through the county program that we use, they usually provide housing, set them up with housing, and start getting them a stable environment so they can start rebuilding their lives.
Yeah, so that question still stands around prosecution and public defense actually gathering information sharing it up to us and potential opportunities for platforms. And yeah, I would add to it the time it takes to settle someone. So I would just propose potentially that data is very important. And I just go back to the chief who said it's a societal issue. It's not, you know, a lone law enforcement issue. And
oh,
so
exactly.
Data and values is important with this data collection. So that's just something that I'd like to see. Councilmember Dale Strunos Johnson, I yield back, but that is something that I think would be important.
The other problem, too, that we run into, and I'm not dealing necessarily with data, but a lot of clients who we try to get into inpatient also have warrants in other courts. And some courts are easier to deal with to get those warrants taken care of. So you get somebody waiting 45 days to get in treatment, get a bed date, and the court won't quash the warrant, so they miss their bed date.
Thank you. Councilmember
Edan. Thank you for the presentation. I really appreciate it. I think you should really come back again, maybe next year or the year after that. And one of the things I'm going to request is a really good, you know, just along the lines of what Councilmember Quinn was saying as to just kind of getting that real data that you're seeing as it, you know, comes to you. But two things that stood out for me is one is the collateral thing that you talked about, that not a lot of people, I've had experiences of people that have had those things happen to them when they made something and then they couldn't get their really their citizens or anything, something like that really affected them. Later on, it took them years and years until that thing got resolved. So just kind of getting understanding how, and I'm really glad that you have some sort of other resources that you could reach out and kind of work proactively before engage any deals or anything like that. But directly, I wanted to ask you is that, you know, how many people do you usually serve throughout the year? And it's just you and David and you know, just two people. How many people coming through the pipe, right? If there's 100 people and you were only about to get to 50 or 60, I want to know as an elected official and what can we do,
yeah,
right, to get that to serve the whole community that, you know, everybody that comes through that. The second thing is we have a lobbyist. We have a lobbyist. We champion ideas. You've mentioned there's a couple of states that have passed the similar actions where, you know, someone was not convicted and they were used against it. And we want to champion that as a city. You know, if you could just let us know what that is and share that with David Klein, that should be on our list on next year, when we're talking to our lobbyists, we want to push it through and champion for something like that in here in our state. So I'll just yield back. Those are the two things I wanted to mention.
All right. I could take that first one. The changes that came in 2012 included case limits, where there are specific numbers set by the Supreme Court that limit misdemeanor defenders to 400 cases. It still sounds like a very big number. But at the time, there were misdemeanor defenders taking over 1,000 cases a year. Because of those limits, it is not just me and Mr. Kirschenbaum. We have two talented other lawyers who work with us. Tim Redrake, who is pretty new to the firm, actually replaced Moy Masaniai, who was one of our defenders for a long time, who's now a King County judge. And he used to live in Tukwila. His kids still go to Tukwila schools. He was a big outspoken proponent of Tukwila. Now he's a judge in King County. So that hopefully he'll be helpful going forward. We also have Laura Monroe, who's one of the most talented young lawyers. We have had a lot of folks over the years that we trained as Rule 9 interns, but we've never had one quite as good as her. She's a really talented young lawyer who we're really proud of. So there's four of us. We also have bilingual paralegal, Viviana Salazar, who speaks Spanish, and she's great to have around. And so that's the core. We are limited to 400 cases. Tukwila itself is usually somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think, around 1,000 cases. going back historically, but that number has been occasionally down. And then during the pandemic, it really went down. For a while, the city wasn't filing new charges. We are catching up. I have a feeling the numbers are going to be up this year, but I'm confident we have the lawyers to cover, not just within the statutory requirements of the case limits, but also to have enough time and resources available to treat each of these cases as well as they should be treated. And then, David, the other question?
I think the other question was just more of a statement that, or that we hope you can send your, we're hoping to work with you moving forward when we look at next year's legislative session, because you had mentioned Massachusetts does not, you know, they don't record or they're not keeping records of. And to share that with David Klein, who could share it with us, because that might be something that we want to champion next year, because that change would need to happen at the state level. It couldn't just happen locally.
Right. Absolutely.
In response to the Councilman's request that we come back next year, we'd be honored to come back next year. And I have to tell you, since 1984, this is the first time the council's ever asked to meet me.
Wow. Well, I'm really glad. I hope this is a yearly thing, just as a check-in with the work that you guys do. It's surely really important to us. And, you know, I do hope that we have you present again next year, because I think the work that you do is very important. And we all are here serving the residents of Tukwila. And, you know, I'll follow up on the data collection piece, because I think as council members, for us, we really have to put numbers to when we're appropriating money, we really want to understand the numbers, the amount of people who are on wait lists, the number of people who need help in those services, because that helps us appropriate money appropriately. but we'll be in contact. I don't have any additional questions. I think my council members asked pretty good ones, but just know this will be an ongoing discussion. I'll likely reach out if we have any additional questions, or if we want to work with you guys in terms of legislative or, you know, reforms in the future.
That'd be great. I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you, I've always wanted to be a public defender. I was lucky to fall into being able to do it, and it's work I really do love.
Thank you. It shows. You guys really care about what you do. We appreciate you.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good luck with the rest of your meeting.
Thank you.
The rest of the meeting. Bye-bye.
All right.
All right. So I'm going to invite Deputy Chief Lund to present, if he's ready and available, on his item. Sorry.
Can you hear me?
Yep. We can hear you. Go ahead.
So I just want to say you are very welcome to be here, and we look forward to getting through your presentation.
Thanks. Appreciate it. I want to do a summary. To kind of fill Councilmember Yadon in, unless you guys want me to go through the whole thing again.
Which item are we on right now?
It's the update on police reform, use of force review.
So that's 1B?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
But yeah, give him a summary and then we'll follow up where we left off. Because Zach wasn't here.
Sure thing. So what we did, this is the first time we've done it, is we did a use of force review where we included our community reps. And what I did is I met with, there was four community reps that were already identified for the Valley investigative team. And we tried to schedule days where they were all available. Sometimes some could make it, some couldn't, but we had three separate meetings. They lasted about 3 hours each. So we were about 9 hours total. And what we did is we went through every single use of force that was reported in 2020. And We had a the process was is a just a brief summary of each incident, the type of call, date and time, location, how the incident, what type of force was used, if the person was arrested or sent to the hospital, and then how it was reviewed by the command staff. Then I would show them a clip of a video showing the use of force, and then I would open up the floor to any questions, and we would just kind of continue that process. We had 54 uses of force in 2020, so it was pretty time intensive. We did learn some things, some processes that, you know, the fact that we did this review, we changed some procedures as far as labeling our body camera videos. We found that some of the cases where we used force, there was not a crime being committed, and a lot of those cases usually were involving mental illness or people that were in crisis. So officers were correctly labeling their videos no crime, and then the retention is only 36 weeks. So by the time we got to the review, there was no video, it's automatically deleted. So we changed that. We changed the use of force retention period to 8 years, the same as a felony crime. So we're able to retain that video evidence. There were no major issues that came up. We had a lot of good discussion. I was very happy with how it turned out. And then we also just finished our first quarter 2021 review. It was about a month ago. Same procedure or same process, and it's been very good. And So any questions you guys have, feel free.
Yeah, thank you. Councilmember Quinn, do you have any questions?
No, I just have a quick comment, just trying to be quick. One, I just appreciate the process improvement here. I have a lot of confidence in the way the oversight folks, community reps were chosen. And so the fact that you're using historical videos as a way to prepare them maybe for that unfortunate situation where they actually have to come in and interpret. So I really like that process improvement. And then what I would just say is that opening yourselves up for just that community review where they're not necessarily professionals in law enforcement. So I really appreciate that. And then I would just say the video piece is really important. What you said was just amazing. And just like back to the previous conversation around collecting the kind of data that will be informative for kind of what you're witnessing out in the field, and also the need. The need is just so great. And so that process improvement where you say no crime, but yet an incident that could probably come back, you know, a little later. So I just wanted to make that comment. Don't have any questions. Like Councilmember Edan said before, I would just love to have you back or a continued conversation on this, because this is just really informative. And I'll just end with saying this. Before dash cams and videos, I reached out to Chief Villa when something happened, and I asked him what went on. And it sounds like this process really gets at that real time. So I just want to say thank you for that.
Thank you.
Councilmember Edan.
Thank you, Councilmember Delastrinos Johnson. Thank you for the presentation, Eric. I just have a quick question. It's the process when use of force occurs to wait for, I don't know what, how many do you wait until you get everybody on to look at and review? Do you wait for the year afterwards? What is the process? So I just wanted to understand that. To me, you know, I'm not in that department, so I just want to make sure that trying to understand the methodology of what's the philosophy. To me, makes sense when something happens, you convene and you look and investigate or do whatever technical terms that are out there are you supposed to do. So I want to understand that. And then the community members that were selected, I remember the process, but I think, you know, just can you talk about how they were selected and what that process was like, and fairly quickly, high level, And then maybe I have one more question, but I just want to give you an opportunity to respond to those.
I'd like to clarify your first question, just so I understand it. Are you asking about the process from when the force is used and how it's reviewed in the department, or how the whole overall use of force review with the community reps went?
Both. So I'm assuming, you know, something, there's a use of force occurred, and then what happens, and then when do the community gathering happens? You know, you have three or four people, and that's led by someone showing them. So just kind of want to understand that the timeline that it initiated the use of force to the timeline that the community looked at it.
Yeah, I got you. So there's two answers to that. The first one is when a use of force happens in the field, an officer is required to report it by the end of their shift. We use a system called AIM. It's all electronic. They do a report. They describe what happened, collect any information from witnesses, the suspect or the person we contacted, type of force used. It's then forwarded to the sergeant, who will review body camera, review reports, give a recommendation if this looks good or it doesn't look good, and then forward it up to the commander. The commander then will conduct a review process. Usually it's also reviewing body camera video, reading reports. Then it's forwarded to me. I do the same thing. I will watch body camera video. I'll read reports. I'll ask questions. And then I'll determine if it was reasonable and within policy, or if somebody was out of policy, we will start an investigation. So that's that part of it. As far as the review with the citizen reps, so the timing of it was kind of, we decided we were going to do this right at the end of 2020. So we had a year's worth of data. And so we had to kind of go through that as much as we could. That's why it took long. But now we've decided to do it on a quarterly basis. So we did one for the first quarter. Second quarter will be ending here in a couple of weeks. And I'm going to already got a couple days planned for July to do a review. So longest time period would be like, let's say something happened March 1st, they would review it in July. The community reps, we do it pretty like within a week. If a use of force happens at the end of June, it could be reviewed in 2 weeks. So it's just quarterly is the best way to do this, at least for now, to make the best use of time, and kind of we can plan it out. So hopefully that answered your question on that.
Just wanted to interject, just to speak plainly. This was a choice that you all made. This wasn't a requirement, and this is new. So
right, correct.
I don't want you to overlook that. It's new, and it's a choice that y'all have made in approaching this.
Yeah, this is all an approach we brought back from the actual independent investigation teams for use of deadly force on a regional level. We were intricate in implementing the I-940 and Lataxa at the beginning of 2020. And with our involvement with that, we saw some improvements we could make and creating some opportunity for transparency and accountability. So we brought it back to the department and implemented it on our own.
Yeah, I appreciate the response. I think it's great that, you know, this is new and you know, there is thought out process embedded in it. When I'm asking this question, I'm asking to just kind of understand. I'm not trying to do a gotcha moment for anyone or trying to make the police department look bad or anything like that.
Well, we don't think that, but we also like the opportunity to brag. We really like, you know, that what we're doing, and it has improved us. So we're proud of it. So thank you.
I'm also proud of it too. So that's kind of just what I just want to kind of understand when this happens, how long it takes. It sounds like it goes through different, at least three people internally to review it, and then gets to the citizens to review that. The only thing I would, you know, if I was one of the citizens, you know, I'm reviewing. Even 20 is excessive for 3 hours or 4 hours. I just think, I know, probably think about, you know, just thinking through that, someone to sit down, I don't know, 4 hours to review 70 videos or, so that's something that just, you know, kind of caught my eye and, you know, figuring out how to do it better is a suggestion that I would like to propose and see if we can figure out to do something about that.
So it's kind of based on the statistics. And for the first quarter of 21, we only had 9 use of force incidents. So we got through those pretty fast. If we had 50 uses of force in that same quarter, I don't know how else we would do it, but I get your point.
Okay.
Got it. And a final note on that, you know, I would defer to the community representatives and what works best for them. So we seek their input, and if it works better for them to do it more often, we can certainly accommodate.
Point well taken. Yeah, I'll just that's why I inserted there if it was me. So do they also get the recommendations, different recommendations of each person that reviewed that use of force? Okay, cool.
Yes, they do. Yep. We go through the whole review process and let them know what the recommendations were. And, you know, 99% of the time, you know, our officers did good job within policy, use reasonable amount of force. And it might have got lost in the last meeting, but you know, one of the things that the comments that was made, and I want to make sure everybody is aware of it, is several times comments were made that they were very surprised and appreciative of the compassion that the officers used after the incident was over. I heard that many times, and I'm glad they saw that. It felt good that our officers are doing a good job, and I was really proud of them. And I based it all on the training that they've had. We've had a lot of training on use of force with I-940 and LaTaxa, and I think they're really putting it to work. And it shows in the work that we've done.
Yeah, thank you so much, Officer Lunt and Chief Griever. Really appreciate you and the whole team. So personally, I support the department, and I think, you know, we're all trying to get to a place where we don't make, you know, a mistake that you know, it's not a humanitarian way or something that can be avoided. So I just want to say my hat's off to you, all of you guys, and thank you. I don't have any more questions.
Thank you. And I don't have any questions other than one thing that we might consider, council members, is maybe inviting the community members at maybe towards the end of the year after they've been able to go through this process, or maybe in a future meeting later this year, invite them to talk to us about their experience. I think it's really great what we're doing here, and it sort of put in perspective for me. I had another council member from another city, and I won't say which one because I don't want to put them on the spot, but they're having trouble even getting this type of advisory board, this community advisory board. And I said, well, Tukwila already has it, and it's going great, because Eric was able to come to our last meeting, even though he didn't get to finish his presentation. We were able to read it and know that the good things that come from it. And so I told that council member that this is a really great thing, you know, reach out to Tukwila Police Department. Oh, maybe they will, about the work that we're doing here. So I just want to say thank you for creating this in our city. And I'm really glad to hear how it's going. So thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, Deputy Chief Golden, we are going to agenda item number E.
Excellent, thanks. I think Chief Whitworth, did you want to kick this off, or did you want me to just take it?
Just jump right in.
Outstanding. I love it for the time. Thank you, council members and everybody on the meeting. I hope you had a moment to read the memo that I put forward. I wanted to start by outlining what the ask is to make it clear. There's three different pieces to this. The first is kind of a course approval. It's something that we kicked off in March 8th, and we're kind of telling you what we've been doing and making sure we're going the right direction. The second is it has a financial component. We're looking for a consensus to send this forward to the Council of the Whole for consulting services. It will be a budget amendment. And the third is we're looking for approval slash direction on something that kind of spun out of the CPSM report. So those are that's the big ask, those three pieces. I'll go back to the first piece is back in March 8th, we have the CPSM report that laid out several recommendations. And we've analyzed that, looked at tons of data, and a lot of those recommendations, not a lot, but some of them were already in place or already in the works. A lot of those recommendations are things that we could put together to move forward with. And so we created a charter, which was an attachment. And the big thing is we're looking to set up a fire advisory task force. So just like the advisory board we were just praising, we're looking at doing the same type of thing, very much community involved and a space to look at what options are out there. We've been having weekly meetings with an internal work group, kind of working off that charter, and we wanted to provide an update. The options that we've been looking at kind of have a threshold of what can we do within the own city. So staying Tukwila Fire Department, as far as what can we do with that, there's options for forming an RFA, there's options for staying status quo, there's if we form certain entities, there's fire benefit charges. So we want to bring all those forward to this task force. And then there's the options of partnerships. We touch basically five other organizations. Three of them are large, one's huge, one being Seattle Fire, and then we have Renton RFA and Puget Sound RFA, also large. And then we have our friends on Fire District 2, which is Normandy Park, Burien, and North Highline. And then we have our friends over in Skyway tucked in there. And so we're reaching out to all of our people to put everything on the table. Because what we heard is that we want to bring all the options forward and evaluate them. So we're looking to make sure we are going in the right direction there. The second piece is what we determined in setting these up. We looked pretty much within our state, what are other people doing, what has been successful, and what are the pitfalls. We looked at who provides consulting services to, you know, so we didn't reinvent the wheel. And we looked at some of the larger emergency services consulting firms, and not a lot of people really dial in and specialize. There's tons of emergency services consulting firms, but what we found is there's basically two people that have kind of specialized in this area. And those people have been hired on a lot of the same projects. Naturally, they work together. And so they're not really a formal team, but they have every successful RFA or kind of going out for a vote for a FBC or looking at these partnerships, they've been involved with those. And so we talked to some of our connections to vet these two. The first person is Karen Reed. She's a local attorney that is a facilitator in standing up these advisory groups to look at partnerships, fire services, and regional fire authority. The other component is Bill Cushman, who is he has 50, and that's 50 years of experience doing municipal budgeting. And Mr. Cushman is a financial analyst that prepares these models that I would find very helpful, and I'm sure the council would. He usually takes about a 7-year chunk, models out what the different options look like. And so he has these formats and kind of the backbone already in place. And so you can imagine with these two people, the skill sets they'd bring to move us forward. And the idea with this consulting, you know, we asked ourselves, what do they bring to the table that we can't do as this internal work group? Well, internal work group, as talented as we are, as connected as we are, we do not have this format, this template, this kind of way of conveying information, because we go back to our number one goal, and that was standing up an advisory task force made up of our community, electeds, subject matter experts. We want the information to be very digestible for a diverse group, so we can present that information to the council. And so in doing that, we think that consultants would be the way to go. And our group did recommend that we move this forward for consideration by our group. The third piece came kind of as a spinoff from our analysis of the CPS report and some pressing needs that are coming forward. And the CPSM report really dealt with the fire marshal's office. A lot of the recommendations either are directly about the fire marshal's office or a product of the fire marshal's office. And with the COVID and the pandemic, really the odd thing was is development did not change. The demand for fire marshal services seemed to stay pretty consistent. And so we looked at what the recommendations are, and we are looking for approval direction on kind of taking this fire marshal office as a spinoff. We've had financial director Vicki Carlson and fire marshal Ben Heyman evaluate what's going on with the fire marshal's office, what the community needs and expectations are, and what other people are doing, kind of what we're getting ready to do for this larger group. And it's out of need. We need to do something about the fire marshal's office sooner than later. And so we're hoping that we get some approval direction to keep going with that group. And that's something that will be presented to the council to say, hey, we have this upcoming need, and here are some turnkey solutions. I don't want to use the word fix because it's not broken, but some ways to meet the expectations and meet what our community needs. Because we all know Tukwila isn't this little tiny, you know, mom and pop shop. We have very, very robust industrial, commercial, you know, we have real high rise buildings. And to serve those needs, we have to make a change there. So, I got the memo. I basically, it speaks for itself. I am available for questions. I did ask Fire Marshal Heyman and Financial Director Vicki Carlson. She's on all the meetings anyway. I appreciate that. But they are also available if there's a specialized question.
Thank you. I really want to sort of frame what decisions need to be that we're really looking for tonight. The first one is to move forward a recommendation on the request for the consultants. And then the second one, if that's a specific request, which is just to be able to move forward with the process of the fire marshal, am I getting that correct to have it be its own process?
And that's why we added that, is because it was kind of going outside our scope. So absolutely, the core issue tonight, we're looking for a consensus for the consulting that has a financial piece to move forward to the council of the whole. The second thing is just everything you heard tonight, are we going in the right direction? And are you good with the fire marshal kind of being spun off with that? It's a very specialized thing, and the person that understands it is the fire marshal, and the financial director has extensive fire service background, and so they were just perfect to take that and run with it.
Okay, thank you. All right, I'll open it up to questions. Council Member Quinn.
Super high level for one and two. I'm comfortable. It's consistent to what we've talked about. It makes sense. Just for the record, if you just look at one of the consultants on the back page, she was the consultant for the land conservation task force. So I've worked with the person many times. So And then the third thing, and I think it's important, and I'm hoping, you know, Deputy Chief Golden and maybe Ben Heyman, I mean, could speak to this, is I'm comfortable with the process. It sounds like a collaborative process. And it all, and so my question is, you know, the outcome is to provide a level of certainty, kind of customer service, good outcomes. Like, that is the intent and the direction. I'll make that assumption. And I just wanted to confirm that because of the specialization as it relates, but also the need, because this is an economic development strategy as well.
So, yeah, I take that, Councilmember Quinn. Thank you. And you hit the nail on the head. It's exactly where there's a lot of financial components to the fire marshal's office. It's one of the few places in the fire department that there's fees attached. There's revenue streams. And there's these different services that ebb and flow with development. And so what they're looking at is a deeper bench, partnerships, sharing professional services like fire protection engineers. It's something that we need, occasionally, but when we need one because it's holding up a big project. So all the things you talk about, certainty, customer service, and economics and just budgeting is a big driver of it.
And I'll jump in here, Councilman Quinn, just to answer your question a little bit too, is part of this push is we had a discussion a couple of years ago in 2019, if you recall, some of you were not on the council at that time, but there was a huge push by supporting a fee change increase for cost recovery, a lot of things that we did to one, get us back up to our comparables and also build it so we could adequately staff the fire marshal's office and provide the services. So the big thing here is, okay, let's pick up that conversation. There's, there's new people on board, but there's also urgency that me personally and the chiefs of, support as well is, hey, we need to do something soon. There's a lot of changes that are coming up. We want to make sure you're clear on the services that we're providing. There's a conversation we had on the service level you would like to provide. And we just started that, in 19 when we did the fee stuff. And it's so important that we can't sit back at all on this, and not that we were, but we're not in a position right now where we can wait for the whole fire department and that result to come out with that information. And I'm really pushing to make sure that we can get your support, hear what's going on, and provide you with some good options and recommendations of how to move forward and what the different, speed bumps will be with one or the other. And Vicky's been super helpful in working with me on this, and we're getting close to having some options for you, but I really want to make sure that you're prepared for that. And the question was asked about an update a few meetings ago, and this would tie in really well with that, I think, of, hey, this is a high-level conversation on, some pain points, some positives, what we've made, what we're not able to do, and here's where we go forward if you want to do this, but also just transparency on what we're able to do with this level and keeping up with the busyness that we've had. So we want to bring solutions and a path forward. It's not rocket science at all. It's doable, but it takes a commitment and everybody helping out for us all doing our part where we work. So,
thank you.
So I'm comfortable with the third. Thank you.
Thanks. Councilmember Edan.
I don't have any questions or comments. I'm okay with the recommendation as stated in the memo. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm also comfortable moving all of this forward. And I just really had one question, which was in terms of the consultants that were selected, was the fire union involved in, making this recommendation of the consultants that we're going to be using?
Sure. And that's a great question. We've invited the labor union to give a representative. President Booth has joined the working group. So he's been at the table from the start. So everything, and I'll address that better in the memo next time. That's a piece that needs to be addressed. But everything that we put forward on this has been a consensus of our group, which includes labor. And I do want to commend the work that President Booth has done, because he's underneath working for the whole district, and he has a lot of counterparts. And he's been doing that and reporting back to us, because as we all know, making sure that labor is taken care of and making sure that Juan has a heads up, we want to have that organized. So when we come to you with these asks, I will surely point out if there's an issue with labor. But at this point, we have everything in good faith going forward, that we have a clear path for anything we ask for. And another thing I missed out, and I wanted to start with this. Our whole group, we started these talks. We are very grateful that the council has given this attention and the CPS report and the support, because the things we're running into are super exciting. It's really taking us to that next level. And I wanted to tell you, this is not about getting rid of the fire department. It's just stepping up, you know, our game and continually improving. You know, you do have one of the best public defenders. You know, I used to work in that field, and the presentation we got, Tequila courts are excellent. And what I just heard from Deputy Chief Lund, I mean, my goodness, we're just trying to keep up at this point, because we are leading the edge on everything. And so I just wanted to tell the council, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I love that you're a public defender. It's all like you're just involved with all of this. You're like, this meeting's super interesting.
I loved it. I was eating it up.
We appreciate just you jumping into everything. I'm excited about what's happening with the fire department. I love the way you frame it. I feel that same energy in terms of how do we make this better and work together with all the stakeholders involved. And I'm excited to see what we come up with in this process. So yes, let's move it all forward. All right. So Chief Drever, the rest of the time is yours. The only thing I'll say is let's at least, council members, do you want 5 or 10 minutes before the next meeting?
If I could, I mean, this, well, I love Chief Drever to speak, but I mean, this is as important, and it kind of goes in line with what the previous presentation was. I think we should all be educated about just giving the report. It's time, so sorry about that. I think we all need to be more informed about what that means, and then the commitments that we should be making, monitoring, and funding.
So focus on C, item C on the agenda first.
Yeah, whatever. We just don't have time to get to the annual report this time. All the reform that's taking place over the last 2 years, specifically the reform that's came out of this most recent legislative session, is so critical to the operations of how law enforcement conducts its daily work, its operations. So I'll give you a high view picture of what we're doing to make sure we are going to be in compliance with the new law. However, I'll also hit some high points that are some areas of concern for the community, or at least what our perception of concern for the community is. This is so important. The Valley Regional Chiefs have gotten together, and we have put together a summit, including our city attorneys. So Emily Breyer from our city attorney's office attended with me as we met with the other Valley chiefs and other attorneys to discuss how we're going to take a unified approach for the region to implement all of the reform, because this crosses jurisdictions. If we go into Kent or Renton, Auburn, or they come into our city and we operationally work together, we need to be on the same page. So we are coming up with unified policy for us to bring back to our own agencies and implement, so that'll be in compliance, not only in compliance with LaTaxa, I-940, and the new recent legislative reforms, but we'll also be in sync with each other. So as we interact as agencies, we're all on the same page, adhering to the same policies, and all meeting the same intent. So you got a flyer from me, or a document from me, that showed the law enforcement reform that directly impacted law enforcement. I'll begin with House Bill 1054, which references tactics. The big one that came out of that, which was we've seen a lot in the national narrative related to law enforcement use of force, which prohibits the use of chokeholds or neck restraints. The one concern we have out of this is they have prohibited the use of neck restraints or chokehold under any circumstances. So what could happen is an officer could be in a fight for his life, and the only thing available for him is to wrap his arm around somebody's neck in order to save his life. The officer is then using what by the bill would be is excessive use of force. And so it cannot be, the officer cannot be charged criminally for that, but per one of the other bills, which mandates that excessive force is a mandatory decertification. So we're trying to work out with the Criminal Justice Training Commission, as well as the authors of the bills, for us to be able to utilize that tactic in a life or death situation. Aside from that, we're in agreement, and we have already been working in policy that we don't utilize those things before the reform even came out. One of the other things that came out of this bill was the requirement to obtain authorization from the highest official in order to utilize tear gas in order to deploy it. So the highest level of authorization is interpreted by the attorneys is the mayor. If you're in King County, that would be Dow Constantine. If you're in a municipality, it becomes the mayor. So before we can deploy tear gas in a crowd control situation, we need authority from the mayor in order to utilize that tool. And we appreciate the intent behind it. However, that creates delays in a situation where we might be able to deploy the tool, save people from getting injured by using that tool. Aside from absent that, you're talking direct force. So in other words, you have a line of civil disturbance officers that are protecting a position. You know, let's use last May as an example, the mall. We had a group of people, about 100 people, that tried to bum rush the east entrance to the mall. They deployed tear gas instantly as they were trying to traverse across the parking lot to get to the door. Not one person was injured, not officer or community member or person that was protesting. And because of the gas, they turned and fled. Had the tear gas not been deployed within a matter of seconds, the next line of defense would have been a line of officers that the community members or protesters would have clashed with. So it prevented injuries. And so the time delay that's going to take to get that is going to create some issues down the road. And we've already been told that a standing order is also not within the intent behind this legislative measure. So in other words, the mayor couldn't sign an order saying, I thus give the chief or a SWAT or a civil disturbance unit leader the authority. It has to come directly from the mayor. This also defines vehicle pursuits and what is prohibited. Unfortunately, there's also language in there that defines pursuit and what constitutes a justified pursuit. And in order to do that, we have to have probable cause. It's probable cause is what we need in order to make an arrest. And most of the time when we first get into any incident, we don't have probable cause. We have what's called reasonable suspicion, which gives us the right to detain. It's Terry versus Ohio, which allows us to stop somebody until we can investigate. If we have reasonable suspicion to believe they were involved, we can't do that anymore. Come July 25th, we have to have probable cause or reasonable suspicion that they are driving while under the influence. Those are the only criteria, and it goes in more depth than that, but it, essentially it is going to be a very rare situation where we end up pursuing, which is good. We try and minimize the amount of time and or incidents where we do pursue. However, if we have a homicide suspect, if we don't have probable cause, we're not allowed to chase them. The next House Bill 1310 refers to use of force, and you've got a very similar situation here where the House bill restricts the use of force except in situations where you actually have probable cause and or you are directly witnessing actions that may result in serious bodily injury and or death. So we need probable cause and or we need to protect somebody from having serious injury done to them before we can use any force. To put that in perspective, again, we go to a call where somebody has been reporting a robbery, a homicide. If somebody comes out matching the description of the person that was involved in that, we would have, as the law is currently written, we would have been able to stop that person and detain them, even use force to detain them if they wanted to run away. However, come July 25th, we need probable cause. So we're not going to be able to stop people until we actually have all the information necessary to make an arrest. So we've been working with legislative authors of these bills. WASPIC has also been working with them to see what we can do to find some middle ground to meet the intent behind reducing use of force, which, by the way, as Deputy Chief Lund pointed out in our use of force review over the last meeting and this meeting, you know, we're already seeing a reduction in the use of force because of the measures we're taking. We, between de-escalation, training on how to utilize defensive tactics appropriately to minimize injuries to individuals, as well as just evaluating, slowing things down so that we just get into fewer incidents where we would have to use force, has reduced the use of force. However, this is going to be one we seriously need to watch as a community, because there will be people that are committing heinous crimes that will get away. We won't be able to stop them and or interfere with them until we actually have the information needed to make an arrest. So somebody will probably flee. We'll have to let them flee until we get the information, and then we'll have to use measures to try and find them later on. And then you have them committing crimes or potentially injuring and making other victims in the process as they move forward. Jumping down to Senate Bill 5066 and the duty to intervene. We already have policy on requiring intervention. The duty to intervene bill put some teeth into it as it relates to holding officers accountable who choose not to intervene. They can be decertified. In other words, they can lose the ability to be an officer. Unfortunately, it also creates some liability for the city, because as it relates to decertification, the Criminal Justice Training Commission will be the deciding factor on that, and they can suspend somebody from being in law or having a certification. So if they don't outright decertify somebody, they can suspend somebody for up to 2 years. However, in the bills also point out that we as a city cannot terminate somebody based upon the Criminal Justice Training Commission's decisions. So therefore, we would have somebody on the payroll that can't act as a law enforcement officer for up to 2 years, and we can't terminate them because the law prohibits us from doing that. Which, if somebody did something worthy of being suspended for 2 years, they should probably not be a law enforcement officer. But these are some of the liabilities that we're going to take on as a municipality when it comes down to these certification decisions. The Office of Independent Investigations, they're moving towards having an entirely law enforcement-free independent investigation team for the state. We currently have independent investigation team. This came out of LaTaxa. These are some of the investigations that we've been doing and TCUIL has been involved in that have brought some of these transparency and accountability measures to the city. We're going to have to wait and see what that looks like as it relates to independent investigations. For now, the independent investigation teams that are set up will continue to do those investigations, but it looks like they're going to slowly, over the course of the next 5 years, phase them out. I'm trying to skim through since we're running short on time here. Those are the big issues that came out of it. And we're also available at any time if any of the council have questions regarding any of the reform and what we're doing. The bottom line is we're looking to work regionally to get together, to put together solid policy that we need to implement before July 25th. So that we're all as a region working together on the same page to meet the intent behind the law, as well as just be in compliance. So.
Thank you. I don't know if there's enough time for questions. I think everybody should get a little break before our next meeting. But Chief Griever, we will put you at the beginning of the next at the next agenda, because you have so many things to report back, and maybe we'll follow up on the legislative reforms that you weren't able to touch upon at our next CSS meeting. But yeah,
if I could offer up a suggestion, whereas July 25th is when all of this has to be in effect, if we were to wait till early August to revisit this, we'll actually have policy that we'll be able to give to you, because we'll have to have it in place on all these measures that impact us. And it'd be even more informative, and we won't have to revisit it again. And that would allow for the council to actually have a more informed position for asking questions as it relates to that, because you'll actually have what it is that we've done to make sure we're in compliance. In the meantime, just knowing that we're working as a region, it's not just the police department. We're working with the city attorney's office to make this all happen so that we can best represent the city.
All right. Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah.
Fine with me.
And then the next one, maybe we could get to the annual report.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. I will call this meeting to a close, and I will see many of you in the next one. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Sorry it's such a long meeting tonight. All right. Thanks. Bye.